In a down economy, consumers often look to conserve and recycle, which has been a boost to local resale and thrift shops. Now those businesses see an opportunity. Some are moving into the empty spaces that bankrupt big box retailers left behind. To be clear, today's new superstore is not a Walmart. It's a for-profit version of the Salvation Army. New Hampshire Public Radio's Cheryl Rich Kern has more.
A secondhand superstore called Savers is about to open on a busy retail strip in Nashua, New Hampshire. About 30 employees in the warehouse sort through the donated dishes, furniture, and books.
Look how tiny that is! It's like baby doll.
The staff rips open heavy trash bags of clothing. Out on the sales floor, the workplace is quieter.
This is actually one of our most interesting things.
Employee Tanya Mounts.
We have a Learn Russian record set from late 50s, early 60s.
The store is musty like a Goodwill shop, but well-designed like a Marshall's. It's in an old Circuit City building, and it's huge, more than 23,000 square feet. Less than 2 miles down the road sits the used books superstore. The parking lot hasn't been this packed since the building once housed another, now bankrupt, electronic chain, Tweeter.
It's going to be $13.94.
Customer Rose Watney grabs a cart and browses the children's section.
Love the fact that you're not paying full price for them, but you're getting really good books. I always walk out with more than I came for.
100,000 books are stacked on metal shelves. The store may not have the warm vibes of a coffee cafe, but it's well lit and organized. As with the Savers store down the street, the used bookstore partners with a nonprofit organization. Used Book Superstore gives a tax write-off to donors. Owner Bob Ticehurst says in turn it pays the nonprofit 5 cents a pound for the books.
The nonprofit raises money and we're able to keep all of our operations going, so kind of a win-win for everybody.
So how are you making a profit?
It's volume. At these prices, being $1.99 and $2.99, it's not like you make a lot on every book, but it continues to add up.
Ticehurst now owns 5 stores. Like other secondhand merchants, he sticks to a simple business model. High volume, low cost of goods, and cheap rent. According to the National Association of Resale Professionals, the multi-billion dollar a year industry is growing. Over the past 3 years, the number of secondhand shops has increased 5%. Gary Musica is a marketing professor at the University of Massachusetts.
It seems like every time there's a new retail concept, sooner or later, somebody decides to supersize it, if you will.
Musica says thrift shops are typically nonprofit. He says now that they've demonstrated their potential during a recession, the for-profits are targeting the same frugal customers. Those businesses are helped because of the leasing bargains they're getting on empty storefronts. What's unclear is, when the economy turns around, how this new business model will play out. For NPR News, I'm Cheryl Rich Kern in Nashua, New Hampshire.
Let's turn now to people who are looking to leave their jobs and still retire comfortably. Problem is, investing for retirement can be complicated. There's lots of jargon, lots of investment choices, and lots of worry about whether those investments are too risky. What if you could replace all of that with one simple act, picking the year you expect to retire? That's what something called target date funds promise. As part of our series on retirement investing after the crash, NPR's John Itzde has that story.
Target date funds, sometimes called life cycle funds, are gaining in popularity. About 70% of all employer-sponsored 401k plans offer them. But so far, only about 7% of all 401k assets are held in target date funds. The great advantage of the fund, says Alicia Munell of the Center for Retirement Research at Boston College, is that they automatically move people from stocks into safer investments like bonds as they get nearer to their retirement date.
Left on their own, they ended up with 65% of their assets in stocks in their 50s. These funds would get them down to 30 to 40% automatically.
The federal government has decided target date funds are a good option for retirement savings, too. It has given companies permission to automatically enroll new employees in the funds if they don't make a choice on their own.
Target date portfolios are a very, very good fundamental idea.
That's John Bogle, who founded the mutual fund giant Vanguard.
You've got some stocks and you've got some bonds, and you add to your bonds as you get older. The problem is they're also darn different.
Investors in target date funds with a retirement date of 2010 found out just how different they can be during the recent stock market collapse. Some lost as little as 10%, even though the stock market gave up about half its value. But others lost four times that much, says Mike Alfred of Brightscope, a 401k retirement plan rating service.
There were investors in 2010 target date funds that lost over 40%. And I don't think they expected, given that they were only a few years from retirement and were in a fund that was supposedly supposed to automatically adjust, they didn't expect to lose that much money.
The problem, says Alfred, is that the mix of investments in different funds varies widely, even ones targeted for the same retirement date. And it became clear after the market plunged that some target date funds designed for a 2010 retirement date held way too much stock. The lack of clarity about the risks involved in different funds has gotten the attention of Congress. Senator Herb Cole, chairman of the Senate Special Committee on Aging, says, quote, "There's no question we need greater regulation and transparency of these products." Another big issue is the cost of these funds, says Mike Alfred.
The research we did for the Senate Aging Committee at the end of last year shows very clearly that these funds are 15% to 20% more expensive than the other funds in the core menus offered to American workers.
That is the core menu of investment options in the retirement plans offered by employers. The mutual fund rating service Morningstar says over half of target date funds have an annual management fee of 1% or more. That doesn't sound like much, but every 1 percentage point in fees can reduce your total accumulation by up to 20% by the time you retire. There are target date funds, though, with fees as low as about 0.2%. Vanguard's John Bogle says some funds are expensive because they double charge. There's one management fee for the funds assembled into the target date fund. Then there's another fee for the target date fund itself.
So there are a lot of red flags flying around target date funds, even as the fundamental idea of structure and increasing fixed income exposure as you age is the right idea.
So, says Bogle, investigate before you invest in a target date fund. John Idstey, NPR News, Washington.
And tomorrow, the big problem with American retirement savings, people aren't saving enough.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris. There's been tremendous attention paid to the millions of dollars Americans have given to Haiti after the recent earthquake. But many in Haiti are saying the U.S. has something far more valuable, something that can help the country make money over the long run. Not charity, but customers. Many Haitian business people are saying to the U.S. government, clothes are our biggest export, so let us make money by selling more clothes to Americans. Adam Davidson and Hannah Jaffe Walt from NPR's Planet Money have the story.
Six Haitian business people, five men, one woman, flew to Las Vegas recently to, I don't think you can put this too grandly, to change the destiny of Haiti's economy.
They were there above all else to see one guy, and he showed up at their modest booth within the very first few hours.
So how many people do we have here from Haiti?
We are six different manufacturers.
Ladies and gentlemen, Ron Kirk, U.S. Trade Representative. The only reason Haiti even has a textile industry right now is because of this guy, or at least because of his office.
Haiti gets to export clothes to the U.S. duty-free, a big advantage over, say, China. But Haiti right now wants more. The current deal, there's a quota. Haiti wants the quota lifted. They want to be able to sell as many clothes to the U.S. as possible. To them, it's simple. Lift the quota and we get out of poverty.
Things seem to be going really well for Haiti at the apparel show. Along with visiting the booth, Ron Kirk makes a big announcement asking every clothing store and brand in the U.S. to buy more from Haiti.
But then Ron Kirk moves on. It's a big world, and there are a lot of poor developing countries that want a piece of Ron Kirk. He stops in on the Africa Pavilion.
I'm from the West African Trade Hub.
Oh, yes.
Ghana, Cameroon.
Now, we have a great program through U.S. Trade with the West African Trade Hub.
then to the Middle East and the Egypt booths.
I know this guy.
Excellent. Huh? Thank you very much this for coming.
How are you been? And now I'm going. Yeah. And when, next month?
Where to?
To Cairo.
Is that right?
I'm going.
I asked Amr Wissa why he's so excited to meet Ron Kirk. He says that without a special trade deal with the U.S., one negotiated by Ron Kirk's predecessor, Egypt, like Haiti, wouldn't have an export apparel industry.
The U.S. really only gives out trade deals if it serves some purpose, some American purpose. Take Egypt.
President Clinton wanted to make peace between Israel and Arab nations, so he thought of this genius protocol to...
Genius?
Genius. I call it genius.
The genius thing there is that Israel and Arab nations only get this special deal if they work together.
Middle East diplomacy through polo shirts.
The deal is called QIZ, and Haiti wants its own version of what Egypt got.
Without the QIZ, Egypt now would have lost its share in the world textiles and ready-made garments industry.
Why?
Because China is a big giant. Vietnam, Bangladesh are offering very, very unbeatable prices. So Egypt now is duty-free to the U.S. if we have a component of Israeli item. So this gives us an advantage compared to the other big players.
Pakistan's apparel industry got a huge boost itself right after 9/11 when they got a sweet textile trade deal in exchange for helping us with the war on terror. Haiti can't offer the U.S. a solution to some major national security crisis, but what they do have right now is sympathy. Americans, of course, really care more than ever before about helping Haiti.
So the Haitians feel this is the moment, and they don't have a lot of time. And so the Las Vegas trade show, that's just the first part of the plan. Part two, and probably more important, is Congress.
This is important enough. I think we should clear it and send it today.
We're now across the country in a conference room in Washington, D.C. Lionel Delatour and Georges Sassine just flew in from Port-au-Prince. They're heads of the Haitian Apparel Industry Commission, and they're sitting around a table debating this point. Should we ask Congress for just a little lift in quotas, something modest and easy to get?
Or should Haiti go big and ask for a much looser quota, allowing five times as many clothes into the U.S. duty-free?
We cannot leave the room without making the decision.
I agree with it myself.
It takes a few more minutes, but they decide it is on. We are going big. Then they get in a cab.
We're going to the Senate office building.
George and Lionel have done so many trips like this to Washington, D.C. They knew before the earthquake that a Korean manufacturer is ready to open a huge factory employing 8,000 people or more if they can just get those quotas lifted.
Yeah, they've been working on lifting the quotas for years. But right now, after the earthquake, when they walk around Capitol Hill, people listen.
First guy we run into, Senator Bob Corker of Tennessee.
Oh, yes, sir. Good to see you. We're hoping to get in there on the way back from Nicaragua and Honduras and Costa Rica and all that. We're devastated by what's happening. We hope you're doing all right.
We are, and you're going to make us be better.
Yeah.
No, when you hear what
hey,
we are working on.
Hey, good to see you, sir.
How are you, Senator?
Right? Everything going all right?
Very well, sir. I ran into Senator Dodd yesterday, and I strongly urge that he should try to make a visit to Haiti.
We'll be down there soon, okay?
We want to thank you for your continuous support.
Certainly, we're going to look at this afternoon. I better go vote, guys. Okay.
Walking around the Capitol, everyone's telling the Haitians, we're eager to do anything we can to help Haiti. But it is very far from a sure thing that Haiti will get a new and better trade deal. Strange as it may seem, there are people who don't want it to happen.
Some textile manufacturers in North Carolina tell Congress, if Haiti gets a bigger quota, it might end up hurting companies right here in the U.S.
There's actually a big battle going on in your closet. The Gap, Levi's, they want to make more clothes in Haiti. They want the quota lifted. Hanes, which already produces a lot of T-shirts in Haiti, maybe more than anyone, is arguing that now is not the time to lift the quota.
Lifting the quota could mean more competitors in Haiti.
It is strange walking around with these guys to realize that all these U.S. concerns, North Carolina factory owners fighting the Gap, Levi's up against Hanes, will determine the fate of the Haitian economy.
Yeah, it could be that a housing scandal in Upper Manhattan will do more to hurt the Haitians' cause than anything else.
Yeah, because of that scandal, Congressman Charlie Rangel, one of Haiti's greatest allies in Congress, is stepping down today from running the committee that decides on trade quotas.
It is likely that Congress will pass some sort of improved trade deal for Haiti sometime this month. Whether or not they'll go big, we still don't know. I'm Chana Jaffe-Walt.
And I'm Adam Davidson, NPR News.
Support for Planet Money comes from Ally Bank, committed to straightforward banking, including customer service with a real human being 24/7. Learn more at allybank.com.
This is NPR.
Over the past couple of days, we've been considering how the financial crisis has affected retirement savings. Many people, of course, have been joking about how they'll never get to retire now. Some people are not joking. But even before the market crash cracked many nest eggs, the U.S. retirement system was in trouble. NPR's John Itzty reports.
Most American workers were woefully unprepared for retirement before the financial crisis struck. Now they're even worse off.
The financial crisis certainly laid bare how inadequate our retirement savings system is.
That's Alicia Munell, director of the Center for Retirement Research at Boston College. Munell points out that a third of all workers will likely end up depending on Social Security for all of their retirement income.
Only half the people are covered by any type of employer-provided plan.
And most of those are 401k plans, which require employees to contribute and make investment decisions. Even before the financial crisis, the average balance in those 401ks for workers nearing retirement was just $78,000. After the market plunge, that was reduced to about $56,000, according to Munell's calculations. That's just not enough for a comfortable retirement, says Roger W. Ferguson, Jr., president and CEO of TIAA-CREF, the financial services company.
Many families at this stage are probably going to be short maybe $250,000 from what they would need ideally for retirement.
That number comes from a study done by the consulting firm McKinsey & Company. To help meet the challenge, President Obama wants to require businesses that don't offer pensions or retirement savings plans to automatically enroll their workers in IRAs, individual retirement accounts. He would also provide tax credits to partially match the workers' contributions. In recent years, the limits on contributions to IRAs and 401ks have been raised. And in addition, the government has encouraged businesses that do offer 401k programs to also automatically enroll workers unless they specifically decline. Ferguson says it's a good first step, but Alicia Munell believes these initiatives aren't enough.
I also think we need a whole new tier of retirement income, both for those people who have to rely solely on Social Security and for those people who have 401k plans.
Munell thinks it should be government-mandated savings, but she says it would likely need to be managed by the private sector to be politically palatable.
Her critique is absolutely right.
That's John Bogle, who founded Vanguard, the big mutual fund company.
Among the things we need, if we get the government to set the structure, is a government agency that says you can only participate in the money manager, if your fees are reasonable.
And, says Bogle, retirement money managers should have a fiduciary responsibility, a legal requirement to act in the investor's best interests. That's something we fall short of today. Plus, he says, easy withdrawal from retirement savings shouldn't be allowed. But TIAA-CREF's Roger Ferguson is skeptical of constructing a new tier of retirement savings.
I think it's very hard in this day and age to talk about another government mandate.
Ferguson believes a serious effort at education, coupled with nudging people in the right direction through automatic enrollment and automatic savings increases, could solve much of the problem.
Many people don't realize that they need to save between 10 and 14% of their pre-retirement gross income to have a reasonable income replacement when they retire. And I think if we talked much more about it, then people would wake up and recognize, you know, how much they have to do.
Finally, Ferguson says, more attention should be paid to getting people to convert at least part of the retirement nest egg into a guaranteed lifetime income stream so they don't outlive their retirement savings. John Idstey, NPR News, Washington.